Shalom. Welcome to another episode of Inspiration from Zion. I'm Jonathan Feldstein, and I have the privilege of being your host, coming to you from the Judean Mountains here in Israel. I like to refer to it as the original Bible Belt. Inspiration from Zion is a program of the Genesis 1-2-3 Foundation, whose mission is to build bridges between Jews and Christians, and Christians with Israel in ways that are new, unique, and meaningful. I pray that you will find this, all of those. Through this program, we're excited to connect you to people and stories in and relating to Israel to give you a window to look through, experiencing aspects of life here that you might not otherwise know about. We want this to be interactive, so please be in touch at inspirationfromzion@gmail.com and send along any questions and any comments about any topic anytime. Or you can reach us at genesis123.co or follow and like Inspiration from Zion on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Stay tuned until the end, as we always do, to offer you a really exciting opportunity. And please feel free to share this with others who will also find it of interest. This past Saturday afternoon, as I was finishing reading my weekend Jerusalem Post, I had to make it a very strong mental note to remember to text my friend Erica Shackney, who's here with us today. Erica's the editor of the Jerusalem Post magazine, and I needed to remember to text her because there's so much going on here. And this Saturday, this weekend, coincided with days in between Rosh Hashanah and the, I don't even know, maybe you have a good word for it, Erica, the observance, the commemoration.
Reverse one-year anniversary, like a very strange anniversary.
Very strange anniversary, and anniversaries typically depict something a little bit more joyous. Of the October 7th massacres that took place. But I needed to tell Erica something important. Well, actually, Erica doesn't know something. I'm about to reveal a secret. But yeah, it's very impressive. I actually live for, and it's not rhetorical, reading my Jerusalem Post magazines over the weekend on Shabbat. If I don't get to read the whole magazine, I don't feel like I've had a complete day of rest. And yeah, really, I felt like that. My wife and I, we've stopped fighting over who gets to read which section of the newspaper because we've sort of worked it out. and we eventually both get to read the magazine and the front section and the second section. But this one was really powerful. And I needed to text Erica just because she's a friend. I tell her that she did a particularly good job. And honestly, I'm getting choked up thinking about it. There was hardly a page that I read that I didn't have a lump in my throat. But it's one of those things that you don't want. You have to turn the page. You have to keep reading. And I do want to mention, so I don't forget, and we'll try and mention again, Eric has been good enough to offer to get me some extra copies. So we're going to talk about how you can get a copy. You can always see the articles online. And maybe I'll put some of them in the show notes. But I love holding the paper. I think this magazine is something that people will want to read, interact with, and hold. And so it was with that I asked Erica if she would come on and talk about it. I know it's a lot of work, Erica, to put together a magazine. You have your cycle of getting the articles and editing them and putting them together and layout. And I know this because occasionally you throw one of my articles in there, which is always nice and meaningful. But it's especially hard now because we're in the midst of the holiday season. It means shorter weeks. And this past week, for sure, I want to just jump right in, must have been even much longer in preparation because it just seemed to me that except for, I don't know, the one that you got a lot of controversy about recently. This one wasn't controversial, but it was super well thought out. Was it? Was this something that you prepared at least weeks, if not months, for?
First of all, nice to be here. And thank you for all those lovely compliments. It means a lot. I think that honestly, like, I was preparing all year for it in a way. Because we always have to look ahead as editors. And in the beginning, you're just trying to get out, you know, you're living day by day, minute by minute after a tragedy like that, like trying to deal with your own personal feelings and put out the paper as well. And over time, unfortunately, you get used to the state of affairs. It never gets easier, but you somehow learn how to cope with it. So I feel like because I worked on every magazine since October 7th, every week, then I had a good idea of the issues of the day. I mean, I obviously couldn't get every issue, but I got a sense of what it was I wanted to communicate to the readers. And I always try to put myself in the reader's shoes. And I feel like I would be a reader if I wasn't the editor. I read everything but very differently. And I just wanted to communicate that emotion and the historical events that happened and tell the individual stories. And that actually was very important to Hannah Brown. You did the opening article, and she did important events from every month. And she wanted to highlight a little bit more of the personal stories as well. So that was my goal in putting this together. It's always serendipitous the way that it comes together. But it's a good mix, I think, of just, first of all, like, just bam, what happened? It's been a year. What are the most important things that happened? Who are people that really had a hand in it? And how do we move on from here?
Right. Yeah, which all, actually, as you say it, and also because I follow you on social media, everything you said makes sense. You have been interacting. Excuse me. You have been projecting. And you have a unique sense of humor that also I think is really important in terms of how not everyone's dealing with the last year in any humor at all. In fact, I feel, I don't know, guilty sometimes being too joyous and light about things. But I'm glad you mentioned it because I wrote down, I always... First of all, Hannah's article at the outset, maybe she'll hear this or you'll just communicate it. I hope I'm not the only one. That set the stage for the whole magazine. And sometimes you have a cover story. It's a cover story. And then you have articles about 20 other things, and that's fine. But this really set the stage. And you mentioned the Chronicle. There's no way. You could do a whole magazine times 20 of just mm-hmm. chronicling of what happened day to day, month to month. But that was super important. I always, I don't think I've ever communicated it to you since Rabbi Tarragon has been writing his weekly Torah Insight. That was very powerful. I got really emotional reading the story about Emily Hand.
Yes.
The 11-year-old girl. Who was
something like that.
Right?
Yeah.
Kidnapped, and she was released, thank God, last fall when that took place. But it became real personal because last week's podcast, I interviewed the nephew of the girl whose house Emily was sleeping in and from which she was kidnapped. So it all clicked together. And
right. This
little beautiful blonde girl, and we remember the traumas that she came back with and how her father was dealing with it. And I always appreciate Batya Ludman and her psychological insights, therapy for all of us in 1,000 words or less. And even
I get therapy as I read it. I need it.
And we all do. And I suspect that it's therapeutic for her because she's also living through it. And it's super insightful. She, you know, maybe one day someone will publish all of these things as self-help for others going through traumas. But God willing, no one will ever experience these traumas that we're experiencing. But I eat and love, and I have to note that the recipes, you know, just that one thing, and it was someone's chocolate chip cookie recipe, I think.
Henry Shore?
What?
Henry Shore? Yeah.
I don't remember. You know, if I start flipping the pages, here, we both have our copies.
Yes.
And I'll make noise. I usually don't like to interrupt, but here it is.
Oh, yeah. Annie Shore. She's a regular columnist. I brought her on because I know her personally, and I knew that she would create, like, very Haimish and accessible food, like home kind of, that would be delicious, but also make you feel at home.
She's
on page 26. Yeah.
26. So for those who are lucky enough to get a copy after this program. You'll note, turn to page 26. On page 40, there's a book review of a cookbook that talks about Rachel Edrie. Oh, Rachel Edrie, what an amazing
Oh, that's what you were talking about. That Rachel was the cookie woman.
Rachel was the cookie woman who fed her cookies and coffee to terrorists who were in her home until special forces came in and killed the terrorists.
For hours and hours and hours.
Right.
She charmed them. She talked them down. Yeah.
I want to get those cookies, but...
me too.
Right?
I want her to bake the cookies in front of me.
Oh, yeah. Let's
Asking a lot, but...
All right, well, wait. Let's make a note of that, Erica. Okay.
Okay.
What... You were planning this for a while, and I'm sure it came together. When you charge all of these people with writing an article, you have a general idea of what you think will come back. What was particularly insightful to you or special that you just had this epiphany, wow, when you read it?
Actually, Emily Hand, in a way, because we've been doing the photography, like the photojournaling with Chaim Schimmel, photographer Chaim Schimmel, since the start of October 7th. And she was going to hostage families and taking photos there. And it's so nice that she could come back and do it with the father who has been through so much and with his daughter. And it's kind of a redemptive story. He had first thought she was dead.
Yes.
He didn't know she was dead. Then he thought she was dead. Then she was alive. And it was just such a roller coaster for him. And I pulled out a quote that said, "I can honestly say I'm doing well." That the father said that. It's intuitive to put out a quote from Emily, but I felt like that was such a part of the story. And I was so happy to hear that he was also doing well. Of course, I'm happy to see Emily home and just free and seeming like a beautiful child that she is. But it's so nice because he suffered so much. So
he suffered so much, and I think we connect with him differently as Anglos because he's also Irish, and so
right. His
communication after she was kidnapped was in English, and it's just easier for us. We relate to it. I remember when she was freed. How he spoke about, and I, you know, you want to know what's going on with everybody, but we don't have the right to intrude or pry.
Right.
And that's a very delicate balance, especially in your business, to do it. But he spoke about how she, for I don't know what period of time, when she was released, would only speak in whispers because she had already conditioned to speak in whispers among the terrorists who were kidnapping her, who had kidnapped her.
Right.
That was crazy. By the way, on a personal note, I didn't even share it with my daughter. I have to make a note. My second daughter has her master's degree in dance therapy and was so beautiful. And I don't know if it's just that's how Emily was expressing herself, but people need to read this article and see the pictures because Emily came and danced.
Right.
And that's so important in recovery, if that's her expression.
Right. And not only that, she's being artistic, but she's doing something that's normal and beautiful.
Yes.
With her father. And we can watch that. We have the privilege of watching her. You know, so because I was very struck when she came back, she was wiping away her father's tears. Like, so it's nice to see them interacting. You know, and I guess you could say semi-normal.
Semi-normal because the picture that you have of, I think, him outside their temporary home.
Right.
Is a caravan. And it won't be more. It won't be less than 3, maybe 4, even 5 years before they're able to move back to their community from which she was kidnapped.
Right.
And so they have to. And as a parent, we are actually launching a program for at-risk youth along the Gaza border, and you want, I suppose, you want to give your child as much normalcy as possible, and you have to do that in the environment in which they are now, knowing that it's still, they're building a home, but it's a temporary home.
Right. But I think, I mean, in varying degrees, like they're experiencing it to the nth degree. But I think for all of us, it's been semi-normal since October 7th. You know, we're last week we had the big Iran attack, and I was in the shelter. Jerusalem luckily has much less attacks than most places, but I was there in the shelter with my neighbors who brought their kids who they're about to put to sleep, and they were just trying. We were all trying to distract the kids, so. Eventually, they in their pajamas, and they did get to go to sleep. But you know, hopefully, they'll be able to process that in a, you know, in a way that will continue their childhood in a normal way. But yeah.
Well, everything normal, everything that we will consider normal for the rest of our lives, I contend, and I would even say my oldest grandchildren, is colored by what happened a year ago and since.
Yeah, it's funny because we talked about the new normal after COVID, but we didn't know how good we had it. And then also when I think about coloring our lives, it was the 50-year anniversary of the Yom Kippur War. And for that generation, that colored their whole life.
Correct. That's my point. Exactly.
And that's going to be our, you know, seminal experience that we're that just changed everything. Like 9/11 changed things, but I this has just been beyond anything. So yeah, I completely hear that. Yeah.
I agree with you. It's been beyond anything, but I'd like you to articulate for those listening why. Why do you say that?
Well, I think it was, first of all, it's the promise of being in our promised land, in our homeland. And I personally came for that reason. First of all, it's just a Jew's supposed to be greatest dream to live here. Like Herzl. And for me, I had it. Like, I was very lucky to have that inside because coming here isn't always easy. So it's good to hold on to your dream. And also, my grandparents were Holocaust survivors. So I always felt we're going to have a safe harbor here. And I was safe here. There's a lot less person-to-person crime. Of course, anything could happen and does happen. But, you know, spiritually, if it's your time to go, it's your time to go. And I feel very safe walking the streets as a single woman, like, you know, just as I wouldn't feel in New York. And Israel felt very safe, very neighborly. And all of a sudden, on our holiday, when we had just had the most beautiful Sukkot holiday, and it was the first time in a long time somehow, oh, because we had had so, it's so hard to believe we were so focused on the judicial reform protests because it had
Right.
been. We hadn't had a lot of tourists for that reason. And now Sukkot, everybody came back. And I just kept saying I was jinxing it. I'm like, this is the best Sukkot we've ever had. And we were all feeling just so like we could finally breathe. And then we all were woken up in different ways that morning. I woke up after 8 with the first siren in Jerusalem. But some people, I mean, their lives ended at 6:29 a.m. And throughout the day, whether you are religious and don't look at your phone or not. I am observant of Shabbat, but I actually, the second I saw like there were a few rockets, I turned on my phone because I said, this is really unusual for Jerusalem. Something's going on. And all day I was just following the death toll going up and seeing all the different parts all over the country. And we had no clue. It was like a ticker that the deaths kept going up and just the horror of it all. And you cannot, like, to this day, I have seen photos. I'm forced to look at photos in my job, but I refuse to look at the very, very graphic photos or watch those some of the documentaries because I feel like it stays with you. It is such horror. It was a modern day pogrom, and you would like to think that people that live in the same country area as you have a heart and are human, and to know that. They're worse than animals. They're monsters, and the things that they did, rape, murder, but like desecrating bodies, and do it with such joy. And like then we got a recording of a Hamas fighter calling up his father, and his mother gets on the phone. I killed 10 Jews with my own hands. They're like, oh, Allahu Akbar, wow, amazing, thank God. And then they bring the little girl on the phone, and you're like, what? It just shakes your whole being. We just want to live in peace. I'm not saying we're perfect, but instead we got a bloodbath and it just keeps continuing. And so we don't even have a chance to process it. We're still in it.
We're still
So
in.
So
There is
that's
no
why,
post-Truman yet.
because we say an anniversary, so October 7th, but it was just saying, okay, this happened a year ago, but it's still going on. And it was just such a violation in every possible way. Like, it was on our holiday. They came into they first time they came into our sovereign land. They invaded our land. They invaded the women metaphorically and physically, and they invaded homes. They took children. They had not a shred of pity, and they took people away from us. And we don't know how they are. And these, I mean, we're all in limbo for the hostages, but these families are in limbo and haven't slept since that moment. And how could we ever be the same after that? And so,
Well, very well unpacked. Let me take a really quick break. I want to come back and talk to you about a year ago and then this year as well. But let's just take a
sure.
really quick break.
As remarkable and miraculous as Israel is, and its very existence a testimony to God's faithfulness, in many ways, Israel's like most other countries. Just as there are parents anywhere who have stronger and weaker parenting abilities, and adults become a product of situations in their lives that they cannot control, making their ability to raise and care for their own children even harder, that's true in Israel as well. The Genesis 1-2-3 Foundation is committed and takes the mandate seriously to care for the least of these, our brothers, our children. We're committed to bless and strengthen orphans and at-risk youth, to invest in them, to empower them, so that their future will be brighter than their past or their present. But Israel is unique in that there are always threats of war and terror which know no bounds. For children who come from homes that are not safe, sometimes the very scary reality of living in a community that's not safe is too much to bear. We are committed to turning orphans and at-risk youth into children of promise. We fund a variety of programs to help those most in need as widely as we can. We invite and encourage you to join us today so that we can ensure their brighter tomorrow. Please visit genesis123.co to find out more and to send your love and most generous donation today.
Eric, I think sometimes it's therapeutic, and feel free to get into it as much as you want, but you already started to unpack it about October 7th a year ago. You woke up about an hour earlier because sirens in Jerusalem started earlier than we did. I had been in a, well, it was a very weird sleep, because I thought I was still asleep, and I was hearing booms. Which made
Oh,
me,
God.
which made no sense because I thought I was
Right.
asleep. So I thought I was dreaming booms and interacting with my dreams, trying to rationalize what the booms could be, not
Right.
realizing that we would hear the explosion of the rockets being taken out or landing in Jerusalem, which isn't terribly far away from where you are, maybe 15 kilometers. But you woke up, air raid siren, one of several that morning for you or that day. What was your day like? You checked the did, wait, I actually want to, in general, I want you to answer that, but did you also, were you also checking your phone? Was there something professional that you felt like you needed to know so you could be communicating? Did you have any sense of that, or was this just
I'll just go through the day and then I'll answer that
sure?
question as I do that. So, I woke up with the noise of the first siren at I forgot the exact time, 8:20 something, 8:29, no, 8:30, I don't know. But I hadn't heard a siren, and I mean, we hear it in on TV, and I've heard it a few times since I made Aliyah 15 years ago, but I hadn't heard a real siren, an air raid, Homeland Security siren in years. And I woke up and I was half asleep and I'm like, I think that's a siren. And I realized that it was, and I started running around my apartment, and I knew that I had to go. I'm on the ground floor. I have to go into the stairwell, but because we didn't have a shelter at that time. So, but I just became almost frozen in like my panic, and finally I got myself out and I stood in the stairway, and then it kept continuing. And then I was supposed to go to lunch. It was Simchat Torah. We all were so relaxed. It was a day off. we were going to go have a nice lunch. And I said, oh, I'm not going. I'm not going to shul. I'm
Shul
not.
Is synagogue for those who don't know.
What? Right. Sorry about that. My Ashkenazi slang. Yeah, I'm not going. And I kept peeking outside. I kept like creeping into the hallway and looking outside because it was suddenly so silent. And I was like, what is everyone doing? What's happening? Who's going where? What's everyone doing? And then I turned on the phone, and then I just was going to every news source I could possibly think of, not just my own. And all day long was updating. And we have a WhatsApp group where we just talk about, you know, these kind of events or events of the day or what we're going to do.
The Jerusalem Post staff.
Yeah, right. But I actually, because I do the weekend, you know, I don't have to report this breaking news in quite
right.
the same way.
Right.
So I just like let myself into the human part of it. And then it didn't even occur to me almost to check the group. And I'm glad I didn't. I didn't want to work then, but some people had to. But that night, you know, the day was endless. I don't even know how we got through the day. I feel like I just laid on my couch and kept refreshing the screen and just wandered around my house like aimlessly. And it was a very strange day. And then at night, I called up my parents. I always call them when I feel like I need some reassurance, even at this age. And I said, I have to go to an editorial meeting tomorrow morning and create a magazine. How the heck am I supposed to do this? And it was the feeling I had after COVID times a million.
Yeah.
And they said, you have a team. You're all going to work together. Just work with the team. And that's what we did. But in the professional capacity, I started thinking about it on Saturday night and the feeling of doom in every possible way. So,
but even on Saturday night, we didn't know the depth of horrible things were. And there were still live terrorists in these communities.
I know. I know. It's a blur, honestly, those first few days. Actually, the first few weeks.
Yes.
Yeah. Everyone was in such shock.
Yep.
I don't think that we all, I don't know if I can really remember it in a linear way exactly. Like, I know what happened that day, and I know when I worked on certain articles that made a huge impression on me, but that's it. And we all were just trying to make heads or tails of it and help each other, which we did. And, you know, I think there was an understanding from everyone in every possible way. Like, everyone is just in this together. We don't know what's happening. It's unfolding. We're going to do our best to document this. But, you know, we're all human. So, and you're supposed to create this barrier between yourself and the news. I mean, I've always been very sensitive, so I have a hard time doing that. But I didn't even have a semblance of that after October 7th. I'm like, this is my people. This is, you know, it felt incredibly personal. So that's how I felt.
How do you apply that now, a year later, creating a barrier? Or is it just, is it out the window? Because in a sense, everything you publish is to a degree part of your diary.
Well, that's a nice way of looking at it. I've never thought of it that way. Thank you. I do a lot of complaining to my loved ones. And I'm like, I'm sick of looking at these pictures. I don't want to talk about it anymore. It's traumatizing. I'm traumatized. But I just complain and move on with my life because it's not quite as shocking as it was the first 2 weeks looking. And I can actually look at photos, whereas before I couldn't even look. But I was forced to. But only I would only look at the ones that I had to look at. Like if we were profiling a specific hostage, I would look at them. But I couldn't bear to look at other ones, like to look at them in like a research kind of way. I just wanted to focus on the material that I was doing. And now, I mean, we've become seasoned with it, but there's also the feeling that we just never know. There's always a twist and turn. So, I mean, it's exciting in a way, but I just really try very hard to protect myself and not see those things that I mentioned, like Nova, the really, really graphic Barry. I haven't gone down there. I refused. I felt like I didn't need to, and I felt like it would just be too much and I have to be healthy to do the news, you know, so I can't subject myself to that if I want to be. But, you know, I struggle with it because it's horrifying and I take it very personally. But I'm glad I do.
So no, I was going to ask you about that if you had gone down to the southern border to the communities. But now, just as you said that, I'm wondering, because you introduced yourself as being the granddaughter of Holocaust survivors, have you been to Auschwitz?
I have not, and I was just talking about that, and I would like to go, but for a very long time, I did not want to go. And my grandmother was there. And I'm actually reading Eichmann in Jerusalem now. And last night, I met the daughter of Judge Landau randomly. But
Wow.
yes. but I feel like I missed that opportunity when I was a teenager to go on March of the Living. I should have done that. But I don't like going back over these horrific. I don't feel like I need to go there to see what was done to us. I feel like I lived it. I had four living people with, tattoos on their arms that were traumatized themselves in varying ways that lost their family. I didn't need to go see the ovens, and I'd seen plenty of pictures. I felt like that about Ground Zero.
Oh, that was I was going to ask you that next.
I've never been. I have not been since 2001. I just don't want to. It hurts to go back and see, like, see it and remember what it used to be like as a lifelong New Yorker. So I haven't, but I think I can handle it now, but I really have to give myself enough distance from it to be able to handle it. So
Do you think everything you're speaking about is personal, your grandparents and them being survivors, us and now a new generation of survivors and Ground Zero? I was exactly going to ask you the same thing. I'm afraid to go. I think it's important to go, but I'm afraid to go. I was also in, well, not New York, but New Jersey that day. Do you think that there are other sites, other things that where there were also atrocities that took place, memorials in Vietnam, Rwanda, that would also trigger you? Or is that different because it's not as close to home?
I mean, I think as a human being, you feel like really overcome, and it's very, and I think the place takes on the energy of the terrible things that happened there. So I would be very, I think I'd be tuned into that and would want to be respectful. But because I didn't live through it in a certain way, or my, and I don't think I would have quite the same attachment. I mean, I'd like to be educated about it, but
Yes.
I feel like it's sacred ground, no matter what. Anywhere that kind of thing happened, people have to be respectful, and it has to be memorialized. So, exactly, yeah. Like Rwanda, like the killing fields, like all
Yes.
these places, yeah. So I would go. I have not, but that I would go to. Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I
Makes
wouldn't.
sense.
If you have limited time, if you're going somewhere, you have to know that that day is going to be a very sad day. So you have to designate a day to do that, because you can't just go and go out to eat afterwards and then go on and see another tourist site. So I would plan it very carefully, but yeah.
Well said. What did you the beginning of this week was you were putting out the next magazine that I anticipate reading over the weekend. But that necessarily occupied a lot of your time on Monday, October 7th. What did you do? How was your commemoration of that?
It was similar, like, to what I did, but with work, in the sense that I didn't want to leave the house. I just deal like that in a way, going into my shell, because I know that I'm going to have to be very much out of it very soon to really experience everything. So I just felt like I wanted to stay in and kind of let the day wash over me and see how I would feel, because we never had anything like this before. We've had memorials, we've had Remembrance Day, but on Remembrance Day of Holocaust and of the soldiers, we know what to do. We know there's going to be a siren. We know there's going to be ceremonies. Nobody had anything organized, and it was our first time doing it, and we're in the middle of it. So everyone just feels so strange. And so I stayed home, and I did have to work. And I mentioned the complaining, and I had a preemptive fit in the morning, but to myself. And I was like, I don't want to do this anymore. I can't stand it. I don't want to look at these images. And then I just did my work. I sat in my house and I just knocked it out. I was like, I'm doing it. You know, it's like any other, you know, I just worked, you know?
Yeah, I sat in front of the TV all day, and actually beginning Saturday night when I was texting you. One thing that's similar, right? It's a very good observation. We know how we're observing Holocaust Memorial Day. We know how we're observing Memorial Day for soldiers and other terror attacks and traumas that the country has been through. But there was no precedent for this on any magnitude. I just felt compelled to suck in as much of what was being recounted and relived. And it's very interesting. My mind kept going back to the days following September 11th when I was so traumatized. I didn't sleep. I was watching the news. Of course, that started and ended in a day. And it took months for the unburying and realizing what the depth of that tragedy was. But as you said earlier, we're still in the midst of it. This hasn't ended by any stretch. Today, there were dozens more rockets fired in, including from Gaza, that they still have, right?
Right. And there was a stabbing attack in Hadera. So, yeah, I mean, every day it feels like there's something.
And I'm glad you noted that, because this terror attack that took place today, and I lose track of it, the one that took
place
the other day in Beersheba. Oh, I know when it was. It was on Sunday, because my son had just gone back to the Army, and his case is you have to transit through Beersheba at the bus station. Both of these that took place were by Israeli Arabs.
Interesting. Yeah.
We haven't been seeing them.
Yeah. There's really no way to know where it's going to come from and what it's going to be. And I worry about this, though, because I also do that. I'm like, wait, there was a terror attack. Wait, what happened? And it's very hard to keep up. Of course, we could look back, but I feel like people are falling through the cracks. That's why it's important to tell the personal stories, because these people, like, people aren't just going to take as much note of it because it's happening so often. Or the wounded soldiers, they have a long journey ahead of them, but at least they're alive. So that's why it's so important for me to do all these personal stories.
Yeah, thank you. I want to take one last break and come back and talk a little bit more about your personal story. But let's take a break.
The restoration of Jewish sovereignty in the land of Israel was an earth-shattering event. For Christians, it was a confirmation that God always keeps his covenantal promises. Today, we are blessed to see God's fingerprints in the modern miracle of the land of Israel playing out in our lives among the people and in the state of Israel. This year, on the occasion of Israel's 75th anniversary, the Genesis 123 Foundation has been privileged to bring together 75 Christian leaders from around the world to lend their unique voices, sharing their personal faith experiences relating to Israel and their in-depth insight into Israel's history and spiritual significance to create an historical, one-of-a-kind, high-end coffee table book, Israel the Miracle. Israel the Miracle's stunning imagery will fill your home with the hope of fulfilled promises and conversations about Israel. It's a perfect gift to anybody for any occasion, and most of all, to yourself. You'll also be a blessing to Israel, knowing that the proceeds will go to bless Israelis of all backgrounds. Be a part of Israel the Miracle and bring the land, the people, and the state of Israel into your heart and into your home. Visit IsraelTheMiracle.com to get your limited edition copy today.
You mentioned earlier, thank you, Erica, you mentioned earlier about feeling very safe here, or having felt very safe here. Do you feel differently now?
Well, I feel like my sense of personal safety in general and in the world and as a human being, it will never go back to what it was pre-October 7th. I just feel like we've, as a world, suffered a trauma that is so deep that there's no way that we could have that level of innocence again. At least that's how I feel. But when I see what's going around in the rest of the world and all the anti-Semitism, I'm thrilled not to be there. Mm-hmm. And I feel very much at home in Israel. And I am not ecstatic, but I am very, very happy I chose to move here, and I feel very safe. I mean, sometimes I look around and I'm like, we're all, today I did, as I was going to the light rail and I saw all the people like bustling, and I'm like, are they worried at all that there's going to be a stabbing attack right here on the city center in Jerusalem? This would be a perfect place for it. And I'm imagining what I would do and where I would run. And we all do that all the time now. But I, in a way, I did that before too. I'm just a little bit more security conscious. And I still feel person-to-person crime here is much lower. And I feel like this is the only place in the world where you can be a proud Jew without having any fear of it at all, ironically, because that's why we're being killed. But
which is ironic, and it's very hard. It's very easy to say, and I agree, but it's very hard for people, Jewish or not Jewish,
right,
who don't live here to understand. I've been doing a massive number of interviews this week, one podcast, but media interviews with places all over the world, and people are asking me, because I was born and spent most of my life in America, about the status of American Jews. And I'm gone long enough that I don't really feel like I have the authority to speak on that. But I did just come back 3 or 4 weeks ago from a trip. And ironically, I felt safer walking around as an Orthodox Jew in Dubai on my two layovers than I did in some of the places than I was in America. And that's tremendously sad.
It's very sad. I mean, I always thought it was inevitable. That's our history. It definitely made an impression because of my grandparents. But also, the Jews, I mean, we had a great run in America, a very long run, and they were very, very good to us. But I think it's important to recognize when, you know, things are starting to not be as good. And
I want to just circle back, because the way you just said is very profound. You said we had a great run, past tense. You didn't say we have had. Was that deliberate?
Well, yeah, because I feel like I really do feel. I mean, I started feeling this way after 9/11. I'm like, the empire has fallen. It's like Rome. I've always been very, very hooked into this, but it just, America could never be the same after that, and it wasn't. I mean, I remember at the time they did a great job with it and everything, but then when I see just the moral chaos that's going on in America in particular, and the level, I mean, it's worse on the outside, I think. I think when you live in a community, in a Jewish community, let's say like my sister lives in Great Neck, New York, and it's beautiful, and you're really, it's a bubble. But I felt it before October 7th when I went to Times Square. And I hadn't been there in quite a few years, and I felt very scared. I went into La Marais, a very good restaurant, and I sat there and I had a wonderful time. But the entire time I was actually terrified. I'm like, someone's going to come in here and shoot us up. Why wouldn't they? Why wouldn't, you know, and this was like 3 Novembers ago, but I just felt this feeling of dread and blackness. And I think America, unfortunately, has had a great decline, and half of the country is still the wonderful American country that I grew up in, but half of it I don't recognize. And unfortunately, that half has a lot of influence.
Also, sometime earlier this year on one of my trips, I rarely go to New York, but I happened to have an overnight for some meetings. And I was staying near Times Square, and I went out to dinner in Le Marais, and I was asking Jewish friends in Manhattan if it was safe to walk around with a kippah on my head. But I also had that tremendous concern. It's a target. You go into a restaurant and anyone, and I just felt that level of unease, which intuitively we should kind of feel everywhere here. But here it's safe. It's normal.
Because I think here we've been recognizing the security threat. We know what we need to guard against, and we've known our entire history since 1948. And every time we forget, we're reminded. So we're not denying that we have a security issue. And I feel like a lot of times in America, people just try to forget it and say it's an isolated lone wolf incident. We know who the enemy is, and we know what they want to do. So in America, you just don't know. You don't.
Well
Yeah,
said.
and here, look, also, if you're infused with this meaning of living here, which a lot of people are, I think, and it's a spiritual feeling too to live here, you feel like you're protected and at one with God. I really do feel a level of protection here, or just a level of oneness. And I don't know. So how could I not feel safe, in a way?
Do you not feel, did you not feel protected and protected because of God living in New York?
I feel like God didn't even enter the equation as much for me. It's like a little bit, it's like clouds separate me when I go to the US and then I come back here. It's like the two worlds cannot coexist. I somehow start focusing on other things when I'm there. It's not that I forget about Israel or my priorities shift. It's just like, I don't know, somehow it feels different over there. And here we're living and breathing the situation and our brothers and sisters, what everyone is going through. And there, it's very easy to forget. So even if nothing was going on, I just feel like not living in a Jewish country, it just you get a little numb, or I don't know, it makes it's a place with a lot of trials and tribulations too, Israel. So it makes you very aware.
And I know you well enough in America. You also seek out the pumpkin spice lattes, which are not available here.
Yeah, I mean, I prefer gingerbread, but yeah.
Okay. So anyone coming to
It's the
Jerusalem, we need some
experience.
gingerbread, Dunkin' Donuts coffee out of America.
Right.
Erica, beginning to wrap up, you use the Hebrew properly. When the attack took place a year ago, it was our holiday, Simchat Torah, in a sense, the last day of Sukkot, the Feast of Tabernacles. Christians know it as, and the literal sense of the word is Simcha. It's joy. It's the joy of celebrating the Torah and the cycle of reading the Torah. How do you? You got a great sense of humor, and are terribly intelligent. But how have
Thank
you
you.
processed the last year in terms of your own joy? Do you feel guilty at all? Is your joy, are you, or do you catch yourself when you're too happy? Or is there no joy or anywhere in between?
Well, I think I had a head start, unfortunately. My brother passed away like a few years ago, and I had plenty of survivor's guilt then. And I went through the stages of grief. I think I'm still in it to an extent, but
You will be.
it helped me understand the ex like what was happening in a way as it happened, and to be a little bit wiser than I would have been. And I have guilt about living in Jerusalem because I feel like the rest of the country is being battered much worse than we are. And we're worried and we're scared, but they're getting sirens all the time, and I don't have anyone in the army that I'm super close to. I can sleep at night, sort of. But I don't know. I think I took the happiness as it came, and a little bit of black humor and just snarky observations, because it helps you get through it. And you can't be miserable because you have to have the, it's a cliche, but the oxygen to, you have to have it yourself to give to others. And you can't be miserable all the time, and it's important. We're not alive, so we could be like just constantly unhappy. So I wanted to live my life, and that's the biggest revenge. But I didn't think about it really, really, really carefully. I just kind of went with my feelings, and it's all been a little bit of a blur. It's been less of a blur as time went on. I definitely do not feel guilty. But the Simchas Torah, that holiday, that celebration holiday, everyone is grappling with that. And you're going to find an article about that. I put it very prominently in the beginning of this week's issue. And the writer said, well, shouldn't you put that in the Tabernacles issue, like in next week? And I said, no, because everybody has to emotionally prepare. Everyone's thinking about it. So, yeah. Nobody knows exactly what to do on Simchas Torah, and I think it's going to look different for everybody. I kind of mapped out a little game plan for myself, like partly go to synagogue and pray a little, do a little dance with the Torah, and then have some l'chaims, like have some alcohol. And I said this It sounds a little pretentious, but to remember and to forget and then go
Wow,
home.
that's profound, though.
Yeah, thank you. And then go home and kind of sink into whatever I'm feeling.
Yeah, I've been grappling. We didn't make it out last year because we just
Yeah.
normally I'm the first one, but we got home at 1 o'clock in the morning, and at my age,
In my age, too.
Right? I was asleep. I was asleep at 9 o'clock when that air raid siren went off. And I really don't know. Thank you. Thank you for giving me. You're creating a sense of trauma that I've already contemplated in wondering, what am I going to do? And, you know, and it's hard to know day to day, because as you and I are speaking today, we're a week beyond that barrage of missiles from Iran, and things seem like they're heating up a great deal in Lebanon. And though while you and I haven't heard a lot of rockets, in fact, except for a week ago from the Iranians, and then 6 months ago in April when they did the same, it's been relatively quiet where we live.
Mm-hmm.
But I just, you don't know that as we finish this conversation, we're not going to be running to our bomb shelters again, or put in a situation because of a fear that the home front command of the IDF tells us you can't gather more than 30 people in any one place.
Right. Honestly, though, that's the thing that has made Israelis so gifted in being resilient. And they really know how to live for the time that they're there. So it's taught me how to live in the moment more, because that's what we have right now. And there is no way to control anything except for yourself. And I tell myself that sometimes, because I try to control, and I'm really worried about what's going to be after the high holidays and what the year is going to be like, since we got such a slap in the face last year, and what more could possibly happen, you know. And I'm nervous, but I'm like, there's no point, because what's going to happen is going to happen. And we're better, we're more experienced now, we're more compassionate now, we're more, you know. And it's going to sound weird, but I try to find something to look forward to in every situation. So when I was in the shelter, I was like, I should have brought a bottle of wine in here. I'm going to sound like an alcoholic with your listeners. But so then I was like, when I get out and go to the apartment, I'm going to have a nice glass of wine. And I started thinking about that. And then I was kind of looking forward to it. And then, you know, it made things a little bit easier, made the time pass faster, you know. So yeah.
I hear that. We distracted Erica from the issue, pun intended, that motivated me to ask you to join me today in this conversation with last week's magazine. Wrapping up, I'm going to ask you to do two things. What else? What other insights from last week that? Again, I want to do a pitch, and I'll just ask people to email us at inspirationfromzion@gmail.com, and we'll do a lottery. I don't know how many issues of the magazine you'll be able to get me, but we're glad to share, and I'm going to share some of the links here as well. But what else did we not cover, and what are you looking forward to as this new year 5785 is upon us?
Okay, so I'll tell you first about the magazine. So the cover itself, it's pretty stark. It's an image of kind of the road with some blurred bodies and people and a yellow ribbon on the right. And it says 1 year later, October 7th, 2024, 2023. And that was important to me, because I don't think you can encapsulate what has happened with an image. And last year, the first issue that we did after October 7th, we had an empty page, and it just said October 7th, 2023 on it. And, you know, with very dark letters. And the Jerusalem Post itself, the Daily, did the same thing, and it left the whole front page blank. So that to me was very important, just to say we don't have the words. We just have to understand how much this is. And then we also did, Hannah Brown, who wrote the cover story, she also did a story about special needs. And her son is autistic. And, you know, they're an important community to think about as well, because they suffer in their own way. Everybody has their own issues. So I was glad that she brought that out. You know, every community should be spotlighted because everyone has their unique issues.
But that also highlights not just special needs people, but in her case, a parent of a special
right.
child, and how we all have to process this, not just in a single dimension, but there are multiple dimensions
Right.
of all of it. And I was glad to see that as well. Her first article, the cover story on page 6, was broad and really super well done. But then she offered that extra very,
Yeah.
very, very lovely and powerful insight.
Right. And it was personal, more personal.
Yeah.
Also, we had an essay on Just One Courageous Individual by Heshi and Rookie Billet. And
yep.
It's funny, Rookie Billet was my high school principal for a year.
Oh.
But I love that she's writing now with her husband for us. But they wrote about a few people, and they wrote about Nicholas Winton, Sir Nicholas Winton. And
true, that was very good.
And then as I was looking at photos, I've seen the famous video of him being like him not knowing, but then saying,
first of all, who is he for those who haven't?
Okay, sorry. During World War II, he was a regular stockbroker. I don't think he was Jewish, right? I think he was. I'm not sure.
I saw the movie. I think maybe he was, but he wasn't really practicing or identifiably Jewish.
Right. He wasn't. And he had no reason to be particularly affected living in the UK with what was going on with, you know, all the children and all, you know, everyone that was suffering in Europe. And somehow he understood the situation, I believe, in Prague. And he said to himself, he had a reckoning with himself. And he said, I have to help them. And he literally moved heaven and earth and bribed people. And he got together this Kinder transport of trains and brought, like, I believe it was something like 550 or 600.
Right, I think almost 700 kids.
Yeah, 700 kids. And he saved them all. And he saved siblings, and he just did it because he felt like it was the right thing. And then you see him, like, when he's an elderly man and he's on this show, and people didn't really know about him until that point, because they rediscovered, I think it was his wife that rediscovered it in the attic, like all his memorabilia. She's like, I had forgotten about it. I mean, I don't know if you can forget about that, but and then they said on this program, you know, first of all, look to your right. A person that you saved is sitting next to you. And he teared up and she teared up. And then the anchor woman said, and could everyone else who was saved by Sir Winton get up? And the whole room got up. And he just was like looking, and they were looking. And it was so emotional. So I just felt that power, you know, by that story. And I think the people of Israel have responded in a really beautiful way. And really gave it themselves. And I also think that people all over the world have really given of themselves as well. And it's just very important for everybody to think about what you personally can do or what you're capable of. I think people are capable of anything, honestly. If Sir Nicholas Winton could save like 600 plus, almost 700 children, can you imagine how many people came out of that? Like a tribe of children, like one person could have. It's like hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people that he saved. And so he was one person. So,
wow, what a beautiful message for people listening now who are also fraught with stress and not sleeping and praying for us all over the world, to be able to have that charge to be like Nicholas Winston. I think the film, it's a relatively new film with Anthony Hopkins playing Nicholas Winston. I think it's called One Life. I saw it on some airplane. I don't remember which one, but
right.
Very well done. So people should. Okay, Erica, and what are we looking forward to this year?
Oh, well, first of all, I feel like it was important for it to be a new year. Even just saying, like, turning that page, we passed October 7th. It's like in warning, you pass 30 days, you pass a year.
Wow.
So we passed a year. Somehow we made it through. So I'm looking forward to that. I don't have to count like now every month. It's this many months after. I'm just looking forward to the normal things. I'm trying to think about the normal things that I would look forward to. Like, I want to make the best out of the Tabernacles holiday. It'll be very nice. It's going to be the winter, so it'll be fun to sit in the house and watch movies on Netflix. And also, I want, you know, I do think that we're not going to be in this forever. We can't. So I'm looking forward to everyone who can coming home. I want everyone to come home, and I want parents to be able to sleep again. Yeah. And I want soldiers to go back to their normal lives. And I want also, of course, the hostages. So I'm really looking forward to that time when we can feel whole again, in that sense that we know what happened to each and every hostage. And yeah, that's on the macro level. On the micro level, I'm just happy to live here, and just looking forward to being here in Jerusalem and seeing what else happens in a good way.
In a good way. Yeah, last time we had a conversation like this, you were part of a panel talking about some of our political dysfunction, which seems so many lifetimes ago.
Right. How innocent we were.
Boy, oh boy.
Yeah.
Not that we want to go back to that, but
no. We've seen a little bit of that, but I think most people just have their, you know, have their eyes on the right thing. Yeah. You know, so.
Erica, I'm so glad you did what you did publishing last week's magazine. I'm so glad that I had that immediate thought to reach out and have this conversation still in the wake of that, we'll go with the word anniversary, talking about what this important document that you edited and put together, and giving people insight as to where we are and, God willing, where we'll be. Thank you for joining.
My pleasure. This is why I do what I do. And yeah. I hope I didn't go off on too many tangents.
I always tell people there are no tangents in Zion, and emphasis on the inspiration. Let me just wrap up. We always offer people a special gift at the end. I've called it for the last 3 or 4 years From Jonathan's Bookshelf. And as I sit here and look at my bookshelf, I used to give away copies of other people's book. But just before the war, a year ago, we came out with our incredible Israel the Miracle coffee table book, inspirational essays by 75 Christian leaders from all over the world writing about why Israel is so important. So all we ask is that you do is comment, like, or share the link to this program. And every month at random, I'm going to pick one person to give a free copy, and it's worth $75. So that's not a little gift. Please like, comment, and share this. We're always grateful that this podcast is sponsored by our friends at the Willow Run Greenhouse in Culpeper, Virginia. If you're ever in the area, stop in and thank them for helping make conversations like this possible. And also to our friends, the Coyne family, for their meaningful sponsorship. Inspiration from Zion and all Genesis 123 Foundation programs are made possible by donations. So please consider joining us to help continue the dialogue and build bridges. And this episode, you know, we never forget the hostages. As of our conversation today, there are still 101 people being held hostage. Many are not alive. We know that, but they're still being held hostage. And Erica alluded to this. Please, God, that somehow in the merit of this conversation and everyone who's listening and taking Erica's inspiring thoughts, that we will see them come home just as soon as possible. If you'd like to sponsor an episode in honor or memory of a loved one or special occasion, please be in touch at inspirationfromzion@gmail.com. As always, we love to hear your comments as part of a dialogue, especially comments about traditional Judaism for our Ask the Rabbi programs. Please share this with others who will also find it of interest. And please continue to join us right here, where we bring you more meaningful conversations about unique topics relating to Israel that you won't hear anywhere else. Wherever you are in the world, I pray that you and your loved ones are all safe and healthy. And I send my blessings from right here in the Judean Mountains. God bless you. Hallelujah.